Welcome to the Sketchy Podcast. My number is 14.
I'm Mr. B.
Today we're going to be talking about a scientific little principle that I read about. Now, you're going to be driving this one mostly because Mr. B is the science guy in the podcast.
Tell us how you got interested in this freaky-ass topic.
So I was reading an article about whether or not guns would work in space. It was one of those things where I'm thinking,
don't ask why, but I had an astronaut to kill. A cosmonaut to kill.
Well, actually, it does turn out that up until recently, every space mission has always carried with it a gun. There are always guns in space. You might think there's like, why would you want a gun in space?
For aliens?
Yeah, maybe. No, actually, the real reason is because there was
psychotic break.
There were a few
space
incidents.
Insanity.
There were a few incidents in which some of the Russians landed in, you know, like the middle of nowhere over in Russia and had to stay overnight, and there's bears over there. So it turns out that actually the astronauts didn't have just a 9mm. They had a shotgun gun. Like, it could fire two rounds of explosive fucking... Like, this was crazy. Like, you had this on the space shuttle, fucking crazy bastards?
That is a crazy premise for a movie. Like, it starts with two cosmonauts playing Russian roulette.
With a shotgun with two fucking...
Oh, it's a shotgun.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
It's a shotgun pistol.
Yeah, that's...
That's fucked up.
That it sounds like an unfortunate necessity.
And get this. So the shotgun pistol, so it has a handle part that's attachable. And when you detach the handle, it can also turn into a machete.
What? Is that necessary?
I told you again, man, when you're a fucking astronaut and you land in the middle of nowhere, yeah, it is necessary. Shit can get real, bro.
Holy moly.
You fucking land in the middle of nowhere and there's a tiger, you want to shoot with a 9mm and make him mad?
Yeah.
No, man, you got to shoot with a shotgun pistol. Anyways.
I bet there's a lot of stuff that happens in space that they just leave out of the logs.
Yeah, they don't talk about it. Like, for instance, there's been plenty of men and women going up there and you know it. That somebody fucking banged up there, but it was just unofficial banging.
Right.
And you're not allowed to talk about it.
Right.
Yeah. But you know,
not necessarily just a man and a woman.
I think, though, that when you're doing it, you've got to definitely have sex with a diaper, because...
Ew.
You know, like...
What do you mean, have sex with a diaper?
Like, I'm saying that you probably should have...
Like, one big diaper that two people scrunch into?
I'm saying that what you're doing is you put a diaper between your privates as you're having sex, because then you cannot...
You can't have that love mist floating around
the air
system.
Exactly. Exactly. Into machinery and what have you.
Oh, mercy, space is weird.
I mean, like, one... If she's a squirter, and like, that could happen.
They screen for that.
You can't be a squirter if you go to space. That's a very important thing.
Oh, golly.
Supposed to. Anyways, so I was doing
research...
You're
trying to figure out how to fire a gun in space.
I was trying to learn, like... Well, first of all, because there's a new game that came out recently, Call of Duty Infinite Warfare, and they're firing regular guns out in space. So naturally, there were some people who were asking, is that even possible or practical or what's... And there was also a YouTube video of a science guy who just talked all about it. And he briefly mentioned this fact because it turns out, he's like, well, the issue is if you have a standard hammer on your gun, and if you fire, if it turns out that the hammer or any other part of the gun has, and they're made of metal and the same metal, and it's in a vacuum and there's no particles in between, they will do something called cold welding. And I was like, I'm sorry, what is that now?
Cold welding?
And so I did a little bit of research, and then my mind was a little blown when I found that in space, things just don't react the way you really expect them to. It can get scary. Like, I've never really considered the fact that I guess when you're in a space station, whatever, there's tons of other particles. You're not in a vacuum, luckily, when you're in these space stations. So you don't have to worry about that. But you fucking walk outside there, and it is a weird jungle of, like, where physics... Well, to your common sense wouldn't work. Like, for instance, you'd think, hey, it's so cold up there, my gun's never going to overheat.
Yeah, your intuition that's been so finely tuned
for
evolution, through evolution, for like the physics of medium-sized objects at average speeds, it fucking breaks down, boy,
so
in
down.
Space.
Yeah.
It breaks down.
It gets bad.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about more about cold welding, because it turns out that it involves several physical forces. It's not just one. right?
Yeah. So
there's a lot in tandem. So we'll need to explain each one and give a brief description of what each one is.
Okay. So the basic story here is there was a scientist named Casimir who was trying to better understand the forces that sort of keep molecules stuck together, but not actually bonded like atoms. It's called the van der Waals force.
Right.
He was trying to understand this thing called the van der Waals
force. So it's like the intramolecular forces
as opposed to inter.
Right.
So you have an atom, or sorry, you have a molecule. Oh, well, let's start from the bottom. You have atoms like H2O, two H's and an O, and hydrogen, oxygen. They make a water molecule. And those water molecules, they'll bump up against a whole bunch of other water molecules every, you know, picosecond, basically. But they're kind of sticky. You know, a liquid is sticky in a sense. Well,
in fact, the van der Waals force is what makes things sticky. When you think about glue, it involves that force.
Right, right. So there's a way to sort of get molecules almost attracted to each other, but not bonded per se, just a little sticky, like a post-it note. It's not permanent, but it's a sort of an attractive force. So it's this really subtle effect that, as you can imagine, it's super fucking hard to
measure.
To understand.
You gotta be like picometers close to each other. We're talking like these tiny, immeasurable motherfucking distances.
So we're used to like forces in daily life, like gravity, you know, things fall.
Magnetism,
electricity.
All those sexy bitches.
It turns out those are the same thing, electromagnetism. It turns out there's a couple others that operate on such a freaking minute scale that your intuition doesn't prepare you for them unless you really try to study them, the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force. As it so turns out, little side note, those are actually a reflection of the same force, which are also combined with electromagnetism. You just have to get to super high energy levels for them to converge. But at the lower, cooler state of the universe right now, they look like four different things. Gravity's still on its own. No one likes gravity. Fuck it.
Loser.
Loser.
We're not even sure if there's such a thing as like negative gravity. Like we don't even know.
Oh, there's weird expansion forces, there's dark energy, there's dark matter, it's an exciting time if you're into physics, if you're into astrophysics, cosmology, particle physics. There are a shit ton of unsolved mysteries, or at least a couple very, very profound ones.
Yeah. And every once in a while I always read about this. Ooh, this discovery could do it. It could solve like the the fact that we just all of the forces that we know about just don't gel together.
Okay, so as well as we want. Getting back to cold welding, the way to understand this is you have empty space. You have the vacuum. When you talk about a vacuum in a physics sense, you're not really talking about the vacuum you use to, you know, clean your carpet or whatever, which is really just a rush of air.
It's like a pressure pressure changer, really. You're changing the air pressure.
It's not wrong, but it's just a special case of something far scarier. Space, like the vacuum of space, is not the same as the vacuum inside your little air pump.
Like the weird thing about
roll around your carpet.
When you go in outer space, I mean, you think emptiness. You're like, there could be massive distances from one particle to another particle, like nothing, like there's nothing. And what's weird is that as soon as you get into that nothing space starts to act weird, like energy will pop in and out like instantly, and like you're like, what happened?
This is it. This notion that empty space ain't so empty,
not at all,
right? So you have this idea of what's called zero point energy. Even in a perfect vacuum of space, you know, the kind that will kill you in a sci-fi movie, there's still a lot going on. Some people have described it as like this quantum foam, an effervescence to the universe. What are they referring to? They're referring to this baseline amount of energy that all space seems to have, and it's enough energy that particles and antiparticles can just simultaneously pop out of existence. It's like they reach sort of a boiling point in this empty mesh of weird quantum soup. So a particle and an antiparticle, like imagine an electron and imagine the opposite of an electron, and if they hit each other, they annihilate each other with a burst of energy, right?
Well, that typically gives off light, though.
Yeah, well, light is electromagnetic waves, so it's all part of this weird foam, this weird zero-point energy. So the Casimir effect is sort of a side effect of this constant creation and destruction of these particles and antiparticles. The best analogy I can give is, imagine you have these waves everywhere. Imagine you're in like a bathtub or an ocean, and all the waves are very, very evenly spread apart. Let's say they're just 1 foot apart. They go on for infinity, every direction, 1 foot apart. That's a big bathtub. And you have these two boards that are almost 1 foot apart. Okay, just picture that in your mind. So the waves on the outside are hitting the board, and they're causing...
pushing it closer and closer.
Every once in a while, they nudge the boards in. There's a little bit of pressure. But there's also enough space between the boards so that another wave can kind of sneak up in between and push them out. You catch that? So it's kind of at an equilibrium.
Right.
Right? So that's two metal plates. That's the... we haven't quantum welded yet, or what do you call it? Cold welding.
Cold welding, yeah.
Now, imagine that those boards get just a little bit closer now, so that no wave can sneak up in between them and push them out.
Like that there's a definitive wavelength
that
it's now sort of like, sorry bitches, so you can't fit in here.
Definitive wavelength and the quantization of energy, those are two ways to say the same thing. Definitive wavelength, quantum. Definitive wavelength, quantum.
Right.
So, so that's basically what happens. If you get within... I think it's a nanometer or two. It's a really short distance.
I mean, it's a hair is 10,000 times thicker than that shit.
Yeah. Way too thick. Basically, what you end up with is all these quantum waves on the outside pushing the two metal plates in, or the components of the gun, if you will, in. And nothing able to sneak up in between. No waves able to sneak up in between and cause pressure the other way. And so what you end up is with this sort of squashing together where other forces can take over, and you get like a bonding of the metal.
But here's the question.
That's the best analogy. I don't know if that made sense.
I remember watching a video where Richard Feynman described it as, he said that at that moment, basically the particles can't really distinguish where, let's say, the edge of the metal used to be when they're that close. It's just basically... oh, you're just part of the family now. Come on in.
You're part of the intramolecular lattice. You're just another... you might be skewed by a little angstrom or two, but yeah, you're part of the gun now. You're part of the metal. So, yeah. So anyway, you get these fluctuations like waves that are part of zero-point energy, that are part of like this sort of quantum foam or effervescence of space. It's totally fucking insane. But that's what allows you to sort of do some cold welding.
But here's the question, though. At the moment where they connect, is there any release of energy? Is there something that's gained or lost from this at all? Or is it not really significant in terms of...
you're going to have a whole like cascade of things that go by different names, like friction, like the release of potential energy maybe stored in the sort of crystal structure of one piece of metal... trying to line up with
like
the other...
like it's tensor strength kind of thing that might be stored up?
Kind of, yeah. Like maybe one metal lattice will try to release energy as it's kind of trying to line up with the other one. There's going to be friction. There's going to be kinetic energy. So there's all these different things at play. But, you know, if at some point or another, the two surfaces are going to touch. And once they reach some kind of equilibrium, it might give off a bit of heat. Might give off a bit of sound inside the medium, not in space, obviously. There's no screaming in space. Eventually, they'll sort of settle in, and they'll basically be bonded at an intramolecular level, and that's where van der Waals comes back in.
Van der Waals?
Van der Waals.
Well, remember, that's the first thing I asked you, actually, because when I was reading about it, funnily enough, in the article, they didn't actually mention that.
There's
that
a connection
force.
There. It was sort of... something, the Casimir effect, as we know today, was sort of found
out
along the way.
Well, my first instinct, and you know I am definitely not an expert in this, but my first instinct would just be like, wait a minute, this force would be involved. Like, as soon as, like, in that moment, it can't not be involved. It's so...
No, and one of the things that's sort of not obvious when you're going through, like, high school science is you have a chemistry class and you have a physics class.
Same thing.
Well, I would argue that physics is more fundamental, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And chemistry that we know now is just a set of shortcuts and tools that let you do really complex, elaborate physics calculations in a quick, easy way. Like those chemical equations, H2O, you know, dividing into, I don't know, hydrogen and oxygen or whatever, mm-hmm. electrolysis. That's actually physics happening. The idea of a molecule, the idea of an atom, and if you keep going further, quarks and
right,
so
but
on.
When
it's all physics, but we need shorthands.
Well, of course, because if you were to actually say, like, is water H2O2? You'd be like, no, it's actually just a miasma of, like, electrons floating, like,
yeah,
you know.
You're not technically wrong, you're just an asshole.
You're like that guy who's like...
that guy.
I know a little bit more than
the
you do.
The staunch physicist, yeah. And then you get the fucking mathematician who's more fundamental than all y'all
right.
base bitches.
Oh, yeah. He's just going to walk in and be like, right. oh, you're a theoretical physicist.
Oh, less than 1% of what I know is used in your world. You don't even understand my discoveries. So, get this. Casimir effect. Are we good with that one?
I think so.
Basically, that's sort of like, it's
I
a bunch of waves, it's a bit of pressure.
It in a way that sort of made sense. I mean, we were trying to vulgarize this. And if... I always say if I get it, I mean, the rest of the people in the audience should be able to get it.
So I thought it would be fun like to connect this to some other sketchy shit going on in the science world. You've heard of the EM drive?
Of course. Science journalist is like, it shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah, and that's the tagline. Oh, my God. It's not often you get like a sensationalist physics article. I guess we had it around the God particle time, the Higgs, like you had popular media wondering like, what is God? What is particle?
Well, there was also the gravity waves thing.
Gravity waves was cool. I don't think that was misreported. I think that was pretty legit.
Yeah, but you remember though, that first part of the gravity waves, they were like, nope, it wasn't good. And then later they were like, it was an error. And then now they're like, gravity waves are real. Right. Like you ignored that first part where you told, like, remember when they showed up that professor who had come up with it and they're like, congratulations, yay. And then all of a sudden I read in a news article and be like, oh wait, the gravity waves were shown to be a mathematical glitch or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess they celebrated too early. Poor old man. But now they go back and they confirm it and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I feel like it's like the whole chocolate is good, bad for you shit right now.
Well, you know what? That's a really good point. The thing that separates pseudoscience, metaphysics, astrology.
Yeah, the sigma level thing.
From what we think of as real science is not what you claimed, not the fact you said it first. It's the reasons and the warrants you have for justifying it, right? So it's like, if you didn't have the evidence, but you had your intuition happened to be right, good for you. You should be credited somewhere in the journals.
Pat on the back.
Pat on the back. And if you ran an experiment that really affirmed it and disqualified other possibilities, then you went one more. You did even better.
That's prize worthy.
So that's good. That's good. It's unfortunate for the dude, but that's how it works.
I'm just saying they kind of stole that thunder away from him at that point. But see, that's the thing about science. They're like, well, the results are not good enough for us to really put our foot down on this one. So we'll see you in a year.
It's you know... Even though I wish it was a lot more accessible and everything, I'm so happy that as a civilization, we've still held on to something that has a very high standard of truth. And I hope that it gets passed on to, you know, the next generations. It doesn't disappear. I sure hope it doesn't get trutherized and turned into, what do they call it in the Trump age? The era of, not facts, it's like the era of...
I forget.
Anti-fact or
sure.
something like
whatever
that.
Whatever you call
anyway,
it.
Anyway, science is the opposite of that. So check this out. The EM drive, quick recap, if you haven't seen the articles, there's tons of good ones now. It's this mysterious contraption. It's like a copper cone with a piece of plastic in the middle. And the claim was it could be used to power a spaceship, but it doesn't have any exhaust. It seems to disobey all the known laws of physics.
Which ones? Not all of them, right?
Well, yeah, there's no, like, there's nothing expelled. So there's no equal and opposite reaction to...
So the first law?
Like, the traditional thruster approach of rocket science.
So you're saying it violates the first law of Newton?
Well, look, there's...
You can't violate that first law.
It was an interesting idea, and I'll try to give you the, like, 1 minute debrief on how it's supposed to work. No one really understands why it works. And I would argue that
It doesn't work.
It's pretty weak sauce. Like the what they've managed to reproduce in the lab. This is published in a credible journal. NASA's behind it now. Because, hey, it's worth a shot, you know?
Why not?
Take a moonshot on a new...
You might have discovered something that breaks the physics. Probably not.
Probably not, but... So here's the idea. Getting back to this... The vacuum with these zero-point energy particles getting created and destroyed.
Oh, they're trying to use zero-point energy.
It's all connected. It's all connected. So
I'll
make it quick. The idea is you create conditions within this closed system, this cone, where... A particle gets spontaneously created out of nothing. There are certain manipulations you can do to sort of make it real or separate the one particle from the antiparticle. You accelerate it with an electromagnetic field, hence the EM drive. And then you just count on sort of the magic of the...
Other particles?
The magic of zero-point energy and the vacuum state to make it disappear... Either I think it's before it leaves the cone, but you essentially accelerate that virtual particle for the short time span you have it around, because they disappear pretty quick, and use that short existence of a virtual particle or a newly created particle to accelerate the rocket, and then it disappears so it doesn't leave any exhaust. Okay, so it's laughable. It's super fucking laughable. And, you know, there's a lot more going on. I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty details, but it's sort of like step one, build cone, rocket shape, engine. Step two, magic. Step three, go to Mars.
Do you know what it reminds me of? So do you remember a couple of years ago when they were trying to measure, I think it was neutrinos, and then there was some news that maybe neutrinos were faster than light? And it had turned out that it was an error in, I'm not sure if it was the calculation or something like that, where they had basically missed, just that mistake in like just a couple of numbers wrong, sort of came out with like, oh my God, it's faster than light.
Well,
oops, no it isn't. Yeah, correction.
The age we're in now to do real experiments, you have to, often your margins of error are way bigger than the signal you're trying to detect in your data. Just like the...
The gravity waves thing.
They were discounting trains going by, like miles and miles away. They were discounting the vibrations from their network equipment in their server room. They were getting down to the fucking details. And so in this EM drive experiment, you might have heard through regular media, I think Forbes ran an article, there's all kinds of articles now saying, hey, this might be our way to different intergalactic civilizations. But just so everyone's clear, the amount of supposed free energy that was, you know, extracted it's from this down. Device, it's in the order of, I think it's millinewtons. It's like nothing. It's really, really nothing. And the debrief I was reading recently, I think the Ars Technica one is pretty good. You don't have to be too sort of technical to get through it. The most likely, the opinion that most people have is that there's some other thermodynamic effect of flipping on this huge energy source that causes this maybe uneven heat distribution on the copper engine itself.
So the copper engine...
Copper is a huge
heat
dissipator.
The copper piece might actually be absorbing the heat and its extraction...
Exactly. It's much, much, much more likely than we've broken all the rules of known physics.
Yeah.
So that's the sketchy part, in my opinion. So anyway, one more thing, Hawking radiation. Have you ever heard about the evaporation of black holes?
So what I understand is that black holes are constantly, anything that it absorbs, it shoots out, although we don't see it, but it shoots out rays of X-rays typically and some gamma rays probably at the same time as well from having chewed up all those stars. So I guess that once that runs out, technically, it should evaporate and then go away, right? Like that's the whole deal.
It's kind of a probabilistic thing in space where sometimes you'll get a super high energy pair of particle and antiparticle, and if you're just lucky enough, and the creation of those particles
is disrupted,
is like right outside the event horizon, the point of no return of a black hole. There's a certain configuration. There's a certain way that can happen where one of the sides of the pair, one of the two particles, will actually fling out into space, super high energy, and the other one will get sucked back in. and the net effect is energy or matter is leaving the black hole, and the one that shoots in sort of is negative energy. And it basically, just like you can have antimatter, negative energy, that's sort
so
of
so this
what's
negative
happening.
Energy, is it compensating for the energy that's already absorbed?
It's flinging into the black hole and it's eating away at it. And eventually the whole thing evaporates. So you'll see these images of these astronomical images and sketches of two insanely powerful like jets of super high energy particles coming out the poles of a black hole. They're not actually getting ejected. The theory is, so the best theory we have for what's going on.
They're being created.
They're being created on the surface. And once in a fucking while, the regular old vacuum we know as nothingness is creating these, very rarely, but just often enough, a super high energy
version.
Okay,
so here's my question.
And it's creating this jet.
Could this explain, what's it called again, the fact that we have matter and not antimatter? Could black holes be the...
Wait. Did you just do a double negative? Did you say matter and not antimatter? What the fuck does that mean, bro?
Okay, the fact that our universe is made of matter, not antimatter.
You're talking about the imbalance of...
So could black holes be furnaces for matter?
Are they a way to like selectively drive out the antimatter? Because... Mm-hmm. It should have been created in equal proportion, but obviously what we observe
are we using
isn't.
Our existing energy to create quote unquote matter using black holes?
I'm not sure. I think it's already, it may have already been studied, but maybe that could be part of the process. My line of reasoning, my line of questioning would be, could it account for the sheer volume of matter we have versus like the sheer size of the discrepancy of matter and antimatter, and take it from there. But maybe the answer, you know,
what's that called again? Super or something? It's got a word.
Well, there's supersymmetry.
Supersymmetry.
I don't know.
I think that's what it was called.
About. Yep.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah.
So anyway, it turns out your cosmic cold welding is connected to the Casimir effect, which is connected to why water is wet, basically. Van der Waals, which is connected to the sketchy ass EM drive. Let's track that story, shall we?
Let us.
And that's connected to black holes. Who knew?
All right, well...
that's sketchy science.
Your brain is probably just about this close to fucking exploding.
Pop!
So let us take a break, and let's talk about the alt-Reich for just a moment. Okay, let's stop talking about science for a minute, and let's go back to the dirty politics.
Let's get to a real mystery of the universe. Tia Tequila.
Yeah. So here's... if you're not familiar with her... do you remember MySpace?
Do you remember God.
Okay, so it turns out that she had the most popular MySpace account.
When no one was on it anymore?
No, when everybody was jumping off that bandwagon.
Wow.
So what she did was she was able to leverage that
still on MySpace?
Into like TV shows and modeling and all kinds
MySpace happened first.
Yes.
Because I just knew her as some sort of... trashy TV celebrity personality.
That came from a basic...
That came after MySpace.
That came from her MySpace fame.
So she was like...
She was the first social media
star. The original sort of did what the YouTube stars have done.
Yeah, basically.
But she was a crossover hit.
She was the first real one to do so.
Hmm.
And, you know, like... her story basically runs the gamut of what you would expect. So she went on, you know, obviously reality shows. She had a reality show which was basically her trying to... like The Bachelorette, but because she said she was bisexual, she had like an equal amount of girls and guys trying to like date her.
Progressive.
This fucking train wreck. Anyways.
Now you have my attention.
Lasted 2 seasons. I don't know what they were doing. Maybe they couldn't find
anyone. They were careening out of control, much like Tia is now.
So, you know, there was that part of her life, and then after that she tried to be on Big Brother, but... when she started to transition over into stardom, it seems as though she began to flirt quite heavily with fascism and Nazism in particular. Now, here's something that is probably not really well known, is that is not an uncommon thing with young people. I actually read an article about a young Jew who flirted with fascism. And you might be, I'm sorry, what now?
Excuse me?
And when you really think about it, actually... Huh? The notion that you have as, let's say, a North American who never had to deal with World War II, and you know about fascism the same way that you know about it through fucking Indiana Jones, okay? Like, not at all. Well, in those kinds of situations, I think that you probably view fascism as rebellious and you know, almost sexy. And so a lot of people are drawn to it because they don't have to do any fucking research.
It's counter everything.
It's counter everything.
Yeah.
I mean, how could a Vietnamese girl claim to love Hitler, all right, and to basically be like, I'm a Nazi. I'm like, you're one of the races that they didn't like, okay? So
yeah,
what's that about?
You know, it's funny, in my various travels to the East and Central Asias, I encountered some young people who were oddly into just Hitler, and they didn't seem to be into it for the same reasons that, I don't know, neo-Nazis would in Europe and in the West.
There are weird restaurants where they kitsch up that shit.
They do, and it seems to be something they've latched onto for some fucking unknown reason.
It's not an unknown reason. Look, if you want to really understand, why is Godzilla a popular character in the only country to ever fucking be nuked twice? Why would they have Godzilla? Because the Japanese deal with things by, like, bombastically exploding them.
Right. Really, well, this was in Japan. It was, where did I encounter this?
Probably the Philippines.
Yeah, definitely India. There was a certain
No, but there's fascist movements in Japan.
It was so bizarre to see someone with, like, a Hitler computer desktop. And I looked at them and, like, huh? What? What?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, check it out. Do you know what that means? So cool. I was completely disarmed. I had no idea what to say.
Well, it can be tough. Because if you think about it, too, like I said before, most of our knowledge of fascism really comes from movies. And movies have a tendency to always make their villains a bit sexy.
Like, is Hitler the new Fonz or something? Like, what happened? Is he the cool bad boy
of
history?
I mean,
now?
What it is
that doesn't make sense.
It is the bad boy of history. Because God. I think that, like I said, people view fascism as a revolutionary force. They're like, well, society needs to change. And back in the day, we're in the 1920s, society also needed to change. People
things
were like,
just got done.
I think that violence is a good way to change things.
Enough of this debate nonsense. Let's get things done.
Let's smash a few heads.
We need a strong leader. Yeah.
Right. So this is why I said, again, nationalism with populism is relatively dark. But the reason that America actually, for a long time, never was able to actually understand its fascist roots is because, okay, you know how you probably make fun of, let's say, right-wing people who associate fascism with socialism.
Right.
But there is actually some connection that I think a lot of people on the left ignore. Like, National Socialism was really actually a kind of a violent and authoritarian, not even authoritarian, I would say, the difference between, let's say, communism and fascism would be that fascism really does believe that, you know, power structures go upwards. That it's like more supposed to be more of pyramid style. And it did believe that, for instance, companies and capitalism was good, but only when it worked for the state. And, you know, they believed in quashing, you know, labor rebellions and things like that. But they also thought to themselves, they are very pragmatic. They said, we need to at least provide a minimum standard of living, which is the socialist part of fascism.
So help society and do whatever it takes.
Exactly.
Yeah, so,
which is why they introduced like the Autobahn, which is why they introduced the Volkswagen, because they want every person to have a car and have a certain minimum standard of living, because they realize that if you're authoritarian, but everybody's got it somewhat sweet, they're not going to fucking do anything against you. They're not going to rebel. So America really rejected the socialist part of fascism, but it absorbed everything else. I mean, like, in the World War II, the fucking talks of Father Kugelin, and his whole, like, oh, you know, the Jews are bad and blah, blah, was huge. I mean, it was fucking massive. So because of that rejection of fascism, of socialism, I think that most Americans always thought that they could easily reject fascism. But what they never realized is that what they absorbed about fascism was its kind of appeal to violence, its belief that sort of, like, you know, companies and corporations were in a better position to dictate the national path, if you will. Like, what direction are we in? Well, we need strong business, and we need a strong leader, and we need to quash rebellion, and we need a fucking minority that we can easily target as the source of our troubles. You know, the Jews were rich. Oh, well, the reason we're poor is because the Jews are rich. So, you know, eliminate the Jews and we'll all be rich.
Step one, find an enemy.
Yeah.
Step two, rally people behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically.
So that old playbook.
Where communism would say, oh, the result of this political strife is merely misunderstanding, because if the proletariat realized how good they would have it with us, then they would jump on board. But again, like I said, fascism is more like the proletariat need their fucking daily bread, but the rest of it they can go fuck off. Like, and so I think that because of its sort of like, you know, its violent, almost sexy nature, it appeals to young people who want, I mean, like they need change. They're surrounded by old people who don't want the fucking world to be any different. So you're going to kind of cling to something that sort of offers you a radical strategy against that, you know, the malaise that you're particularly feeling. So this is why you have the Tia Tequilas. Like, there's a photo that got her in trouble. So her Twitter account's fucking banned, and she's been banned for Facebook for a long time. But the picture that did it was her doing a Zig Heil at some kind of fucking party, and there's a bunch of dudes. But one of the guys in there is also this Jewish kid.
Huh?
Fucking, yeah, exactly. Flashing a Zig Heil. Why? Because he's probably a stupid, dumb kid who wants to appear rebellious, cool, and yeah, you know, like they think that they're like the sexy Nazis from fucking Indiana Jones.
There's
and it's not that
there's
shit.
Another story, I think it was today, from a major U.S. university, sort of frat party, where, what was the headline? Like, exceptionally racist costumes were used. And it was just, I think, young people trying to come to grips with what the hell is going on with the world, and probably being pretty dumb about it. But
well, they want to be rebellious.
Dressing up in every trope, like the Asian hat and the, you know, the shakeout outfit, and it's just wild.
Well, think about it. Okay, so I'm trying to remember if this was Monty
but
Python.
But Tia's not a teenager, right?
No.
Not that it excuses it, but
anyways, so I'm trying to remember if it was like, there's this famous comedy troupe. I think it might have been Monty Python. They did a bit once where, when they were really young, this is before Monty Python days, I think, where they went to this church and they did all kinds of like weird things. I think one of them did a, you know, like a Nazi salute or whatever. Young guys trying to fucking shock the establishment. And years later, you know, they talked about it and say, you know, I regretted doing this. Again, I'm not sure if it is the Monty Python, but it was a very famous comedy troupe. And they were just trying to explain the fact that they were doing this because at the time, it was shocking to people. And you got to realize that young, rebellious people will try to use every trick in the book to shock the shit out of you. Because one, they want attention. And two, they want to appear like cool and, like I said, rebellious, right? The rebel without a cause. And if you have no cause, and if you don't really have a fucking ideology, and you can just grab something that seems sexy, weird, and evil and make it your own, of course,
right,
they are.
It's
an
easy.
Asian person's going to say Zig Heil like it makes like, sense. A fucking Jew is going to say Zig Heil like it makes
it's
sense.
It's sort of like the salamander-like instinct to get a reaction from someone.
Yes, basically.
I'm just going to reach for the most shocking fucking trope possible.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's what's behind that, and I think that it's a large part of what's also behind what, you know, if we term the alt-right, but what I jokingly call the alt-reich, is I think that all these frustrated people are like, oh, well, I can just, you know, I can attribute whatever I want to this ideology, which is why I think everybody has to kind of, if you want people to jump off that bandwagon, get back to the motherfucking history books and start actually teaching that shit, because they don't know. They don't fucking know. Like, they think they know. They went to an article that agreed with everything they said on some fucking dipshit WordPress site. They gave them absolutely no facts, told them what they wanted to hear. Hitler wasn't so bad. Really? He came this close to destroying Germany. When he was losing, Hitler told his generals, burn Germany to the ground. He was forcing kids to fucking fight. And if you weren't fighting, you would be hanged. So yeah, no, he was a good guy. Real good guy.
Desperate
good
times.
Guy. Yeah. He destroyed his nation.
Wow.
Real fucking good guy. Okay, let's move on.
Can't have it, no one can.
Let's move on. Let's talk lastly about a movie that's coming out this weekend that you didn't hear about because you know nothing about pop culture.
So this Rogue One.
Rogue One, yeah. So this
the first thing I have to say, I was shocked to hear it was a Star Wars film.
Why? Because it's so close.
Well, I heard you talking about Rogue One all day. I thought it was some like, honestly, I thought it was a Pokemon theme game.
Wow.
I'm
Woo! Okay, so
some of the things
the...
I know about
Why
physics I lack in
Why is it shocking?
Well,
what the fuck?
When,
why is it so shocking about
I,
it?
I thought we've Wars run movie. The course of those movies. Like, isn't it over?
Right. And you what you didn't even see in the intro, because you watched about a minute of the trailer.
That princess. Looking pretty dumpy. What's up with that?
Supposed to be the princess.
Oh.
No, it's just that now Marvel movies, especially with Star Wars, has a habit of casting ladies as the main role because...
Is this a Marvel production?
Disney. Disney has a habit of like now casting the main characters in their Star Wars movie as girls because to be fair, in all of the Star Wars movies, like the from 4 to 6, there were two girls in the entire universe.
Wow.
So they were missing some ladies.
Right.
Okay, so you know, I've heard some complaints. Honestly, I don't care as long as the story is good.
But, so answer me this, like the one thing I sort of understand, correct me if I'm wrong, is the Star Wars movies were released in a certain sequence and it was like 4, 5, 6 or something, and then
which were the first movies?
The first movies, and then
The other ones are supposed to be the
in
prequels.
The 2000s it was like 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah.
So where does this one come in?
This one is basically right it's right before 4. So the story is...
Why do we need that story?
Good point. Well, let me explain to you why they thought that was a good idea. So it's basically the story of the group of rebels that stole the plans that they needed to use to destroy the ship.
Already know what happens in the grand scheme of things. So fucking cares.
And you know what? Like this is why I said you should watch the whole fucking trailer, because at the end of the trailer, guess who pops out for a fucking little visit?
Oh, don't tell me. Jar Jar.
No. Darth Vader, dude.
Oh,
and they make
really?
A big deal out of him. They're like, look, Darth Vader. And I mean, you can...
What
so the
age
movie,
is he? Is he a teenager?
No.
No,
he's in full costume. This is basically 2 weeks before fucking The New Hope. This is just like... This is just as the Death Star is being built. Now,
sounds really lame.
Yeah, it does sound lame. Okay, what's really lame about it, and this annoys me about the kind of Star Wars movies, is that Star Wars is so invested in their pre-existing mythos that it can't even exist. It can't even create new shit. They're like, okay, we can make any story we want in rich universe. What should we make? And what did somebody lift up their hand and say, can we make it about the guys who stole the plans of the Death Star? No, dude. We're so done with Death Stars. I mean, the last Star Wars movie had another Death Star.
Oh, come on.
And like, okay, so this leads me to a little bit of a tangent, and I'm going to talk about super weapons and why super weapons suck ass. All right?
How do you define super weapon?
So a super weapon is kind of like, it's a weapon that you're going to spend a ton of money investing in. It's something that you've never done before. You know, it's a completely new imagining of like a war machine.
It's super in the sense it's like way bigger than it normally would be, or
no,
way
it
more
could even be,
way more deadly,
it could be
or
imaginative even in its sort of super weaponry.
The technology is sort of freaky and alien. Yeah,
but okay. So the problem with a super weapon, the first problem is that when you think of a super weapon, you probably think, okay, the first thing that comes to mind is atomic bomb.
Right, that seems pretty fucking super.
So, yeah, because that's a super weapon. And when you really think about the atomic bomb, most people probably think, well, the atomic bomb helped stop World War II. Oh, you naive little idiot. No, it didn't. The super weapon of the bomb was originally developed because they thought when they started they were going to need something like that. But actually, Japan was leveled before they actually blew it up. And Nagasaki and Hiroshima were the only two cities that had not been firebombed because they wanted to specifically test this weapon. But it had no real war strategic value. Fucking zero, okay? None. It was just that they had already spent so many fucking millions of dollars on this thing. And they were like, well, what the fuck are we going to do with it? Let's use it.
All this crazy talent that was brought away to work on it.
The smartest people in the world to make this. I mean, and it's kind of like right before there was the nuclear bomb, the Germans were working like crazy about trying to make V2 rockets and shit. Spending untold money, labor, research on trying to make these rockets because they're like, hey man, we have these rockets, we're going to be able to win the war. No, fool, you're already on retreat. Like, you should have been forgetting about your super fucking weapons and getting back to basics. But this is, I think that everybody always thinks, I'm going to build this super fucking weapon and it's going to totally shift the tide of war. Like, another good example of what the Russians... Not the Russians, the Germans had. They had this fucking mega cannon, What was it called? I can't pronounce it. It was called the...
Yeah, it was called the, well, the Heavy Gustav or the Schwerer Gustav.
The Schwerer Gustav. So imagine a cannon that is the size... I don't even know how to describe how big this thing is.
It was on a railway.
Yeah.
It wasn't a rail gun, but it was a railway.
You had to move it on a gun. Yeah, on a railroad. Yeah. And the cannon, this was basically like a giant, you know, like a cannon. So it could fire like 48 kilometers or something like, what was it, 29 miles? Or yeah, 29 miles.
So it was designed specifically to level the French forts.
Right.
Right.
So the French had actually built like something called the Ligne Maginot, which was just a series of fortifications because they didn't want to fight any more wars. They were like, we're done. The trench killed them. I mean, like, they lost, I think it was for every German soldier they lost, like, and they had, like, two soldiers. Like, it was bad. All right? Like, they got their ass kicked. And they were traumatized from the war.
This thing was pretty big, eh?
Yeah.
It was a length of 155 feet, 47.3 meters. And just the barrel alone, 106 feet, 32 meters. My God.
Yeah. So this thing, now, you would think, man, this must have really been used a lot. It was fired 48 times. And then so they were trying to shell the fortifications, but unfortunately with a gun that big, the barrel was damaged from just having fired like a couple of rounds, so they had to change the barrel. And it's not like this is an easy barrel to fucking change here.
So the projectile would shoot out at 2,700 feet per second, 820 meters per second, and you would be able to fire one off every 30 to 45 minutes.
I imagine it's because of the cooldown.
Boom.
Yeah.
Ouch.
So it gets fired 48 times, and then they dismantle it because they were going to use it for the Russian offensive. But because of how big it was and how difficult it was to move, it didn't get used there. And then finally, when they were trying to use it in the Eastern Front, they had to fucking dismantle it because they didn't want the Allies to get a hold of it and to use it against them. Which is the second problem about super weapons, okay? Sure, you develop a fucking super weapon, but then the enemy gets a hold of it, and now what? Like, if you were just developing a bunch of guns, right? Ooh, they get a hold of your guns. Big fucking deal. They already had guns. But they get a hold of your, like, fucking nuke or super cannon or V2 rocket shit, and now they have it. Like, what the fuck? You made your enemy stronger, doofus.
Maximum firing range. Get this. 47 kilometers, 29 miles.
Yeah, that's a long
time. Wow.
Yeah. And could you imagine the noise that fucking thing make? Everybody would have been probably deaf who fired it. Like, there's no earplug that's
get the deaf guy to man it. Yeah,
basically.
Jesus.
I'm surprised your head probably wouldn't shake. But my point is, so the Death Star in the Star Wars universe, there have been three Death Stars. All of them were destroyed. And if you look at how much they actually destroyed themselves, so three Death Stars destroyed four planets in total. This is not a great ratio. Okay.
So what was their purpose? Was it really just a deterrent in the movies? Or did they build them to see some action?
Well, I think, again, so when you're writing a movie, you need to have you need to have a climax. And so the Death Star represents a very, very simple to understand climax. This is why they cannot stop fucking doing this story, because they're like, super weapon has to be brought down. Booyah. You know? Because the thing about a super weapon is it's dangerous. It's a fucking weapon. Like, its danger is immediate. Like, it's almost like if you're watching a movie about a virus that's spreading and it's, like, in a vial, you're going to be really focused on that little fucking vial, right? The whole movie, you're going to be like, what's going on with the vial? What's happening with the vial? So it's the same thing with the Death Star. Because this is a moving death machine that can fucking destroy everything, I mean, it's really like the tensions are high. That's why at the climax of the movie, the Death Star is about to destroy the rebel base. That's why they have to stop it right then. I mean, it's in movie sense, it's kind of the ticking time bomb, right? It's dangerous. You know exactly what to expect. You know it needs to be taken out. It's a force. So this is what makes the Death Star kind of an interesting thing. Now, they reintroduced it in the third movie.
Cool. It looks cool.
In movie number six, and you're kind of like, okay, you did that before, but then you realize that actually the whole Death Star thing is a trap to bring the rebels in to try to destroy them, because it's actually functional, but it looks like it's not. So they were going to use that to destroy the rebels. Okay, you destroy the first Death Star, let's build another one to kind of create a trap, which does make some sense. Now, the recent movie that came out, they just built a bigger one.
Not a trap.
Not a trap. It's just really bigger.
Doomed to fail.
And it could shoot like multiple planets at once, I guess. And that's the advantage.
Wow. Lame city.
So lame city. Lame fucking city. So now you have a movie.
So should we see it anyway? Does it look like a good movie visually?
Visually,
does it look entertaining?
Visually looks brilliant.
Yeah.
In terms of like the shit, it's all practical effects, which I love and I'm a big fan of. But I'm begging you to not give money to Disney at this point with these kinds of movies for just one simple reason. Demand creativity, okay? When you're revisiting a story about a villain who is dead and centered around a plot point which was destroyed, you're just like, "What? Why the fuck am I watching this, man? Like,
yeah.
What am I gaining from
this?" It feels like you're being cheated out of a good movie ticket, right?
You are.
And probably an hour and a half of your time.
Like, all the characters look interesting, but what they're doing is such well-trodden territory that I'm bored talking about it.
At least, like, you know, period pieces, as much as I hate them, we know the ending, but it was real. This seems like the period piece of the Unreal universe. Like a quaint reflection on something that happened, and look at the interesting characters around during that time. Who cares?
I know.
It's fiction.
It's really
do
just...
Do something new, man.
Do something fucking new. Like, why does your villain have to be Darth Vader? Like, okay, so here's the thing. Darth Vader in the movies, in the first movie, he's not the main villain. He's actually the side villain. He only became the villain later on because he's just so fucking cool. The main fucking villain is... like the guy who actually blows up the general, like I forget what his fucking name is. Suddenly, I don't know why. Moff Tarkin, I think his name is. Anyways, he's the bad guy. He's the one who actually controls Vader and he's his boss. In the second one, he's the bad guy. But in the third one, he's actually the good guy because he kills the Emperor and he saves his fucking son. So he's a bad guy for one fucking movie, the main bad guy for one movie. And now you can't get over Darth fucking Vader. Like, the day that Star Wars fans can get over Darth Vader is when their universe can grow. But until then, it would be like if Star Trek couldn't get over Kirk. Like, everything was made about Kirk. You'd have, like, pre-Kirk movies, post-Kirk movies. You'd be like, fuck Kirk in the ass. I need something new. This is a universe you're trying to create here. Let's get some new blood. Huh? Some new fucking blood.
I don't get it.
And these guys are going to... they're projected to make $150 million this opening weekend. Everybody's going to be giving them their money. And I'm like, don't do it.
It seems like such a safe play. Like a safety dance. Like they know that the people who saw Star Wars growing up, they have kids now. They want to go to the movies with the kids. And maybe it's just nostalgia.
It's 100% nostalgia.
It's lame.
It's lame. I mean, as soon as I explain to you the plot, you're like, what's the fucking point? You don't know anything about it.
I don't know anything about this.
But you're already like, I don't want to go see it because I already fucking know what happens. Yes, you do.
Yep.
You didn't watch this movie and you, the most ignorant pop culture person I've ever fucking met in my life, knows what happens.
I couldn't even get through the trailer.
All right. Well, I guess that covers our podcast for today. If you're going to go see Rogue One, screw you. And if you think that I'm wrong about it, you know what? Leave a comment. Why don't you prove to me that I'm being the cynical bastard and that we should be count ourselves lucky. This is what I hear from people. We're so lucky to have a Star Wars movie. You were brainwashed, okay? But if you think that I'm wrong, why don't you go ahead and you fucking tell it to me. To my YouTube face.
To my digital face.
To my digital face. Say it to my digital face.
Let's have a digital duel in the comments section.
Exactly. And it would also do some, you know, us good in terms of spreading the word. If you guys are listening to this and you like the show, remember, we're just starting over at the beginning. Tell your fucking friends. Force them to listen to the show. It's not going to take them long to love it. You know that.
Yep.
I mean, we're going to be doing this. Not only are we doing a show every week, but...
Some other goodies
we're
going to
be doing
out.
Tons of other goodies stuff, so you guys should be totally paying attention to our YouTube channel.
We got our eye on what's sketchy, all the hypocrites and bastards and weird cultural items coming your way.
And as long as I stay angry, which I can't
foresee. Oh man, he's so pissed.
I can't foresee a future in which I'm not angry. Then the show can continue. The show will go on.
Man, we gotta get Goud on the show one of these days. He's a hoot.
Oh well, there'll be more Goud segments, but you know.
Goud!
Let's not overpromise things. We promised them a show today. We delivered that. For my number is 14.
I'm Mr. B.